and welcome to this week's Ukraine Calling program. I'm Oksana Smirichuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We'll have a roundup of the weekly news, some culture, and some music. We're bringing you a feature interview with Professor Oleksiy Haran, who explains the new reintegration of Donbass laws. But first, as always, the news. Ukraine's new law on education continued to make headlines this week. The Ukrainian law was on the agenda for discussion at the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe on the 12th of October. The Assembly then passed a resolution on the law with critical recommendations for Ukraine. They were in regard to education in minority languages. It stated that it does not appear to strike an appropriate balance between the official language and the languages of national minorities. This law has also been submitted for assessment to the Venice Commission of the EU Parliament, who should have their statement by December. Last week, foreign ministries of several neighbouring countries, including Hungary and Romania, had expressed their concern about the law on education in relation to language rights for national minorities. The Hungarian foreign minister went so far as to announce his country's intention to block any further rapprochement between Ukraine and the EU due to the language issue. Ukrainian foreign minister Pavlo Klimkin sought to reassure Hungarians, both through publishing statements in the Hungarian media and by a visit to Budapest on October the 12th. President Poroshenko, while on a visit to Strasbourg, France, on October the 11th, unveiled a new memorial. It's called the Star of the Heavenly Hundred Heroes, and it's on the Avenue of Stars near the Council of Europe headquarters. The star is notably the first monument outside of Ukraine to be dedicated to the Heavenly Hundred and the Euromaidan. Poroshenko took the opportunity to remark on the star as a symbol of the return of the Ukrainian nation to the European family. The two Ukrainian border guards who disappeared while on duty on the Ukrainian-Russian border in Sumy Oblast on October the 3rd have not yet been released. This week, a spokesman for the Ukrainian Border Guard Service confirmed that information had been received that they had been put on trial by Russian authorities. They had been charged with illegally crossing the border and with insubordination to law enforcement officers, and as a result are to be detained for 2 months. Ukrainian consular officials have not been allowed access to the two border guards. A Ukrainian teenager, Pavlo Hryb, went missing in late August while meeting with a girl for a date in Homel in Belarus. He was found later illegally detained by the Russian authorities in a detention center in Krasnodar in Russia. He had been charged with allegedly abetting terrorism. The teenager is in need of medication for an existing medical condition. The Ukrainian foreign minister is currently attempting to send some Ukrainian doctors on the request of the European Court of Human Rights, despite not having received permission from the Russian authorities, to examine and treat the detained young man. After a relatively stable situation on the front, pro-Russian forces reportedly increased the intensity of their attacks against the Ukrainian army towards the end of the week. The most active fighting was happening in Donetsk region. As a result of these confrontations, 8 Ukrainian servicemen were wounded. Meanwhile, the head of Ukrainian Security Service, SBU, Vasil Hrytsyak, stated on October the 7th that Ukraine has evidence of Russian private armed companies being involved in the war in eastern Ukraine. In particular, it has been reported that the SBU has documents to prove that the so-called Wagner Group has been fighting at the front and eliminating key figures among the pro-Russian forces. The Wagner Group, according to Hrytsyak, is a notorious unofficial unit of the Russian Ministry of Defense, which is armed and trained in Krasnodarsky Krai, Russia. 6 months after Russian MP Denis Vorononenkov was gunned down in central Kyiv, Ukrainian authorities have finally announced the results of their investigation and the name of the person who ordered the killing. The Prosecutor General of Ukraine, Yuri Lutsenko, stated that Vorononenkov, who was shot in March of this year, was targeted by a Russian FSB-led criminal gang leader, Vladimir Turin. In his press briefing, Ukraine's prosecutor general explained that Ukrainian authorities are convinced, on the basis of received intelligence, that the assassination was connected to Vorononenko's testimony as to the presence of Russian troops on Ukrainian territory. He would also have been providing evidence for ex-president Viktor Yanukovych's high treason case. The prosecutor general explained that Russian special services had created a plan to eliminate Vorononenko as a witness so that he would not provide evidence in Ukrainian and international courts. Prosecutor general also stated that investigators had uncovered enough intelligence to trace five persons involved in organizing the killing. Now, two of them are in police custody, two are on an international wanted list, and the actual killer died of gunshot wounds inflicted by Vorononenko's bodyguard. Six Crimean Tatars have been detained in Crimea by Russian authorities in a wave of arrests. On the 11th of October in Bakhchisarai, there were a series of house searches of Crimean Tatar community activists. According to lawyer Emil Kurbedinov, the following men were arrested: Marlen Asanov, Server Zekiryayev, Ernest Ametov, Seyran Saliyev, Mehmet Belyayev, and Timur Ibrahimov. The FSB in Crimea claimed that they had arrested six alleged members of the Islamic group Hizb-ut-Tahrir, which has been declared illegal in Russia. The Crimean police had also detained five other Crimean Tatars who had come to the houses while the searches were taking place. The men had been beaten by the police while being arrested and then later released. They announced that they were filing complaints against the police. Ukrainian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mariana Betsa sharply criticized Russia over the detentions, saying that this was more proof of discrimination against Crimean Tatars in occupied Crimea. And now for our feature interview, Marta Dechok interviews Oleksiy Harany about the new reintegration of Donbas laws.
Last week, a bill on the reintegration of Donbas passed in its first reading by Ukraine's parliament. But it was full of drama, scuffles, and even a smoke bomb. To help us understand what that was all about, what this will mean, is one of Ukraine's top analysts, Oleksiy Harany. He's professor of political science at the National University of the Kyiv-Mohyla Academy, research director of the Democratic Initiatives Foundation, a regular commentator on Ukraine Calling, and he has traveled regularly to Ukraine's war zone. Professor Harany, thank you very much again for finding the time to speak to us. Let's start with the timing of this bill. I follow Ukraine's politics pretty carefully, and yet perhaps I wasn't paying close enough attention. What is the timing of this bill? It seems to have just appeared out of left field. Can you explain why these bills were adopted last week?
The timing actually was one of the main arguments for president to adopt these laws quickly. Why? We should go back to the fall of 2014. After the start of aggression of Russian regular troops, and after that there were Minsk first agreements. And the basic thing was to stop the fighting and to have a ceasefire. And in order to reach ceasefire, there were also some compromise or concessions from Ukrainian side, because Ukraine at that time had to adopt a law on the so-called special measures of special modus of self-government in some areas of Donetsk and Lugansk regions, specifically the areas which were occupied by Russia and pro-Russian proxies. And definitely Ukrainian deputies and Ukrainian population didn't want to adopt this law to give them some special status, some kind of autonomy which Russia demanded for the occupied territories. But Ukraine adopted this law, and actually it became one of the signs for President Poroshenko. It became one of the tools to show that Ukraine is ready for concessions. However, the law should come into force upon important condition that Russian troops should be withdrawn from Ukraine, and free elections will be held in these areas. So it was adopted again in fall 2014. And the law lasted for the period the functioning of this law was 3 years.
Ah,
okay?
That's
so
the timing,
the law
3 years.
Didn't
okay.
come into force because there were no free elections, and there were no free elections because Russian troops didn't leave Ukraine. So we had this law, the law was adopted, but it didn't come into force, and it was for 3 years. So basically on October 18th, it will
expire.
Finish.
Right.
It will expire. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what would happen next? And again, it's a diplomatic game, because both Ukraine and our Western partners, they do understand that Russia is not going to implement Minsk agreements. For us, the most important thing is security part. Russia doesn't want to do it, but we need some symbols that Ukraine is ready to implement, and Russia is undermining the agreement. So actually, it was a suggestion from our Western partners, which was agreed with President Poroshenko, let's continue this law for one more year. And by doing that, Ukraine will show that it's ready for, Ukraine is ready to implement the agreements. Who is undermining agreements? Russia. And for our Western friends, Western leaders, it would give, again, additional argument to persuade their own parliaments, their own public opinion, that the sanctions against Russia should continue. So it's quite complicated, you know, diplomatic game. So, therefore, President Poroshenko introduced two bills into Rada, one Ukrainian parliament. One was about general Ukrainian policy towards the occupied areas. And the second one, the second law, was actually very short, kind of two paragraphs, about continuation of this law on special modus for special mode for self-government in these areas. And there was a debate because, frankly speaking, for us, for Ukrainians, it's very unpleasant to talk about some, even to talk about some things that pro-Russian proxies should receive. Receive for what? Some kind of autonomy when Russian soldiers are on Ukrainian territory. But that's why politically it's a very sensitive issue for Ukrainians. And Ukrainian opposition also tried to use it in the campaign against President Poroshenko and against the government. So that's why there was very dramatic discussion. And finally, this law was adopted. However, what is interesting that in the final text of this law, there's no reference to Minsk agreements, because Ukrainian MPs they didn't want even to show that Minsk agreements are part of domestic Ukrainian legislature. Okay, but basically, the law implements some of provisions of Minsk agreements.
So there are two laws you mentioned. One is on the reintegration of Donbas, and the other is the creating of necessary conditions for peaceful resolution. So which one is the more important? Are they both important? Because my understanding is the second one, creating necessary conditions for peaceful resolution, that was adopted. The controversial one was on the reintegration of Donbas. Is that correct?
No, both actually were controversial. Mm-hmm. Both. So the second one, the small one, is about...
Which one is the
which
small
is called,
one?
Creating conditions.
Okay.
For two paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it continues the...
This is the continuation of the bill from 2014?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
For 1 year. So again, this law now is adopted. The first one is still, it passed the first reading, but we are moving to the second one. So to sum, again, this is quite complicated, but Ukraine fulfilled the promise that, okay, we are going to give some possibilities for the occupied areas, some specifics of self-government. Again, if Russian troops withdraw Ukrainian territory. So what does it mean practically? When we are discussing this law, we should understand that in reality, we don't expect that during next year, something serious will change Russian position. So basically, it would mean that this law will not come into force. But this will give more arguments for Ukraine and for our international partners to continue pressure on Russia. So this law was adopted. And now we may go to the first law, which is more elaborate and which is talking about other things.
So the law on the reintegration of Donbas, which is only passed through the first reading, this was proposed by President Poroshenko. Russia is named as the aggressor, the occupier. What else is in this law that still needs to be adopted?
So basically, this law was demanded by Ukrainian society, by experts, by political opposition to President Poroshenko for a long time. To call officially, legally, to call Russia aggressor. And Poroshenko hesitated because in his public speeches, actually, he was talking about the war. He called Russia aggressor. But there was even some declaration from the side of Ukrainian parliament calling Russia to be an aggressor, but there was no law which was adopted by Ukrainian parliament. And the reason for that, I believe, was partly pressure from our international partners because they were afraid to call Russia aggressor because it would complicate the situation in negotiations with Russia, talks within the Normandy format, Minsk process. Basically, this was their view. So that's why President Poroshenko hesitated to introduce such a law to Rada, and it didn't benefit his ratings because political opposition used it to the full extent. So actually, the time was ripe long ago to introduce this law, to call Russia aggressor, and to recognize that these territories where there are Russian troops, which Ukraine doesn't control, are temporarily occupied territories. So this is very important. So finally, we fix the state in legal terms.
But what else is in the law? This is important, the declaration. But what substantively does this law do? What is it supposed to accomplish other than recognizing or stating officially that Russia is the aggressor?
It's not only a declaration, because now it creates legal possibilities. So it says that Ukraine is not, Russia as aggressor is responsible for these territories. So we may apply to international courts because Russia, we consider that Ukraine is not controlling these areas. Russia is responsible for that. So we may sue Russian government. What else is important is that officially what's happening in the east of the country was called by Ukrainian side anti-terrorist operation. And it was anti-terrorist operation until Russian regular troops invaded Ukraine in late August 2014. And after that, it became military conflict. It wasn't just, you know, anti-terrorist operation. It was full-scale military conflict between Ukraine and Russia with tanks, artillery, multiple rocket systems, and so on and so forth. So what's in this law? The law recognizes that we have not an anti-terrorist operation, but we have Russian aggression, military aggression. So it creates new legal framework for the army. Because now, other legal norms and rules would be applied to this situation. This is very important for the army.
Can you give us some details? What sort of changes will be possible now? What do these new norms allow the army to do that it previously wasn't?
It means that on the front line, basically, the full control will rest with the army, because previously, formally, it was anti-terrorist operation was headed by the head of security services of Ukraine, okay? Not by the army. So now it's under control of the army, and it reflects the situation. So it applies military norms, not just norms of normal life. So this is important. It creates the chain of commanders, and basically, de facto, it existed, but there was no enough justification by legal instruments for that. Now there are these instruments which are in place.
Has there been any international reaction to these new pieces of legislation by Ukraine?
The reaction from our international partners is positive, and that's Ukraine. What Ukraine expected, as I have explained to you, that it helps Ukraine to continue international coalition, which impose sanctions on Russia, and not to be fooled by Russian propaganda that this is kind of civil conflict in the east of Ukraine. No, it's not a civil conflict. It's Russian aggression. So, and because Ukraine nevertheless introduced some compromise approach which corresponds to Minsk agreements, it gives arguments for our international partners to say that Ukraine is ready to move forward and Russia is not. So the reaction from our Western partners is positive. Russia definitely said that, you know, this is a sign from Ukraine that Ukraine is not going to solve the conflict, but this is not the case.
Some commentators in Ukraine have said that this law is unlikely to have much of an impact. Would you agree? Will it be implemented? Will these new legislation, will this have an impact on what's going on in the Donbas?
Look, at the end of the day, what will happen in Donbas definitely defined is not by laws, but the real correlation of forces in international politics, in situation in Ukraine, and the situation within Russia. However, as I have said, there are important things. So first of all, these laws, they give possibility for, they give legal arguments for Ukraine to sue Russia in international organizations and international courts. It creates necessary legal framework for Ukrainian army to conduct a military operation. And finally, it helps to cement sanctions against Russia. So this is part within the diplomatic offensive in order to stop Russian aggression and to make Russian troops to withdraw from Ukraine. There are different fronts in this war. There is a real front in the east of Ukraine. There is informational front against Russian propaganda. There is international front with sanctions, with discussion about peacekeepers which could be sent to the area. And so there is a fight on all these fronts. And in this sense, these laws are helpful. Although the laws in itself, they will not solve the conflict.
And of course, there's the domestic front. There was quite a lot of opposition, from what I gathered, to this new legislation in Parliament. The bill on reintegration of the Donbas still has to go through a second reading before it is formally adopted. What are the chances that it will? What, can you look forward? When is this supposed to go to a second reading? Will it be adopted?
According to procedure, And here is there's no such a rush as with a law which continued the mode for self-government for 1 year. So according to parliamentary procedure, there are 2 weeks for introducing changes for discussion within the parliamentary committees, and then there is a possibility to approve it in the second reading. Opposition has some suggestions. They are criticizing the approach of President Poroshenko and the governmental coalition, and I believe that actually some things could be introduced. For example, they said that it's important to introduce the date when Russian aggression started. Okay, it's important to cover the area, geographic area, which is not controlled by Ukraine in this law. It's important also to mention Crimea, okay, because Crimea is also under occupation, in order to somehow to connect, at least symbolically, Crimea and Donbas, in order to show that we are not going to bargain Donbas for Crimea, and vice versa. There is a criticism about that Poroshenko would like to concentrate more power in the hands of the army. There are some misreadings in the text. So actually, I believe that some things could be taken into consideration and changed, to be changed. The question is, so I think actually from Ukrainian government and president, it should be wise to take some suggestion from opposition to the text of the bill, like what happened with the mention of the Minsk agreement. So it was omitted. Okay, it was omitted upon suggestion of opposition, upon suggestion of Poroshenko's ally in the parliament, the People's Front. So, and it's fine. So I think some could be introduced. The main thing is that opposition in the Ukrainian parliament, they would like actually to show that they are more patriotic than Poroshenko himself. So this is part, again, this is part of pre-electoral game, because in actually next year there would be a start of presidential campaign, which is supposed to be in 2019. Actually, that will be in 2019. Then we will have a parliamentary campaign. So parts of opposition, they would like to build their campaign on the criticism of Poroshenko, and they have some grounds, not only in domestic politics, in regarding economic situation, but they would like also to demonstrate that they are patriotic and President Poroshenko is not. So I expect harsh discussions, but from what I see, there would be enough votes to have this law in the second reading as well.
Thank you very much. So we'll be watching carefully in the next 2 weeks to see which amendments are adopted and whether this law passes its second reading. We've been speaking with Professor Oleksiy Harany. I'm Marta Dechork for Hromadske Radio. Thanks for listening.
Singer Katya Chilli used her art to protest against plans to build a mall on an archaeological site in central Kyiv. She joined the activists and held a concert and performance at the 11th century site, which is located under Poshtova Ploshcha in the Podil neighborhood. Archaeologists uncovered an ancient town there dating back to the Kievan Rus era. They believe it has significance relating to the adoption of Christianity. Developers, however, are planning to build a supermarket on the site. Katya Chilli and the activists plan to continue their protest until those plans are changed. We'll post a link to Hromadske Radio's report about this with photos and videos on our website. Vasil Simonenko was only 28 when he died as a result of injuries sustained during a beating at the hands of the KGB in 1963. But the poetry of this dissident poet not only lives on, but continues to have a new life. A young Kyiv band called Zamit Shtastya, which means for a moment of happiness, recently recorded a new single to this poem, Yana Pumro, I Will Not Die. It's a love song, so enjoy.
Розпачу і муки, лиш в одинокі ночі навесні, всем будуть сниться милі теплі руки, і оченята сині і ясні. І будеш ти у кожному диханні, і будеш ти навіки при мені. Гасить зірки очима на світанні, палить мене в безжальному вогні. Ждати кожної години в далекому чи близькому краю, одну тебе, тебе одну єдину, маленьку милу дівчинку мою. Будеш ти у кожному диханні, і будеш ти навіки при мені. Гасли зірки очима на світанні, палить мене в безжальному вогні.
Next week, we'll bring you the promised interview with Marta Kolomeets, director of the Fulbright office in Ukraine, which is celebrating its 25th year of operating in this country. We'll be back with even more news, culture and music. So tune in again next week for a new edition of Ukraine Calling. We'd be happy to receive any feedback from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Oksana Smerechuk in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.